Shrink Wrap Radio number 538, The Little Dog That Could, with Filippo Voltaggio.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
On today's show, I'll be speaking with Filippo Voltaggio, life coach and author of the inspirational book, The Little Dog That Could. For more information about Filippo Voltaggio, please see our show notes at shrinkwrapradio.com. Filippo Voltaggio, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you, David.
Well, it's great to have you here after some technical difficulty of you being on Skype, me being on Zoom, but we finally got it together.
Right.
And before we start discussing your charming and inspiring book, The Little Dog That Could, maybe you could hold up the book, as a matter of fact. I don't have a physical copy here. I read it online. Super. Okay. That's the book that we're going to be discussing. And maybe you can take us through your background. You have a very Italian name. Were you born in Italy?
Actually, I thought I was. I was raised speaking the language.
Yeah.
And we went to the Italian store and the Italian church, and all my parents' friends were Italian. And it wasn't until I went to school that I thought, this is odd that everybody else is speaking English. Because I was born here in America.
And interesting.
So we were also in an Italian neighborhood. So yes, I thought I was born in Italy, but I was actually born here.
You've got the best of both worlds, right?
I do. I actually say that on stage when I'm singing. I've often said I have the best of all worlds. I have the heritage of Italy.
Yeah.
I was born in a great country, America, and I look Jewish, so I have it all.
There you go. And the name is just so wonderful, Filippo Voltaggio. You just want to say it and say it over again.
It's like music.
Yeah. So you've had a very interesting journey, career, which we... You just gave us a little hint of.
Well, actually, it started there. The changes, as you know, we have our show, Life Changes, and
right.
it's very much the story of my life, because at that moment or around that time, my life changed or had to change, or my view of the world had to change when I realized that the world that I thought I was living in wasn't the world I was living in. This is not an Italian world. This is an American world that we were living in or are a part of. And it just kept going. That set the stage, whether I knew it then or not, for looking at the world always in a different way. So all the way up to this moment, before we go back to the story of the book, in this moment, I can choose and do choose to look at the world in a different way than I did in 2016, for example.
Yeah, okay. Well, going back, you've moved through some different careers. For example, you started out as an engineer. What kind
yes.
of engineer was it?
My degree was in electrical engineering and computer science.
Okay, yeah. That was my original goal, actually. I was accepted into university in electrical engineering, but I quickly switched out into creative writing and then discovered I could quickly starve to death as a creative writer, you know, in my early 20s, and decided I had to have a profession and became a psychologist. Now, your bio also indicates that you achieved considerable success. You worked in a number 3 Fortune 500 company. May I ask what company it was and what you
IBM.
Did there? IBM. Oh, I've heard of them. Yes. Okay. And but you're also a musician.
I am.
What can you tell us about your musical career?
Well, I was always musical. My parents say that they put me on the kitchen table to entertain their guests and family members on occasion before I can even remember. And
I've got the picture of that in my mind.
I don't remember it.
Little guy standing on the table holding forth.
With diapers on or something. Right. And so I was always entertaining and asked to entertain. It just was in my blood. And, you know, the interesting thing about the different changes that I've had in my life and the career changes, or I should say additions, because I never stopped really doing one in my mind. Mm-hmm. I just stopped doing it every day. It's been an accumulation of all this information, and here I am today. I am all of that.
Yeah.
And the thing that I'm just now starting in 2017 to encourage people, as I have had a chance to look at my life changes, and I have had successes, as you say, in singing and not necessarily as an electrical engineer, but that degree helped me get the next thing and the next thing. I look at all that and say, wow, I've done a lot. And a lot of it I didn't want to do. Hmm. But I applied myself because my father made me do it, or life led me down that way, so to speak. That was my journey. And I look at all that and I said to myself recently, I didn't know I really did all this until I really looked at it all.
Yeah, sometimes the things that we don't want to do turn out to be the very best things.
Right. And it's good to be able to stop and look at all that and say, okay, I've done all that, and what do I want to do with it? Or take a moment and be proud of it, or just take it in. And when I started to take it in, I started to realize that I would not have done or I would not have achieved the things that I've achieved in the various careers if I didn't have the mindset that I had, that my father used to say I was stubborn and thought I could do everything. And that was a bad thing to him.
To him, that was a bad thing.
And now I look back and say, wow, a lot of us could do a lot more than what we're doing. And I think I could even do a lot more than what I'm doing now, and I want to. And I think that we're not necessarily encouraged to, a lot of us don't have the impetus to or the support. And I think it would be exciting if a lot of us did a lot more, like yourself, David, with writing and psychology and engineering. That makes you more of you.
Sure, sure. Yeah, and I wouldn't trade any of it.
There you go.
Yeah.
There you go.
Now, your musical career also got you into the movies.
Yes.
I assume you were performing in the movie, maybe the lounge singer, or I don't know what. I haven't seen
exactly, actually.
Yeah, okay. Okay. And then you became a life coach. That seems to, is that really kind of one of the very central things for you now?
It is very central to me. It actually laid a foundation for everything that I'm doing and going forward in my future. And there again, it was something I didn't want to do or didn't know I was doing at the same time. I would have people call me. I remember spending hours on the phone with this person and that person, friends and friends of friends. And they would tell me that that's the best advice I've gotten. Or I'm thinking, well, I just gave you advice. I was just talking. I mean, I don't know. And like, is that why you called me? Or, you know? Yeah. So I was surprised of what that was about, and that I had something to offer them.
Yeah. Now, I don't know if it was to solidify your coaching, but you went out and you got training in numerous modalities, and including Absolutely. NLP and hypnotherapy, among other things.
It was. I felt like I needed a foundation, a background in what I was actually maybe already doing, but wanted to know more of what I was doing and make sure that I knew what I was doing going forward.
And as if all of this were not enough, in your ever-expanding pattern, you have a podcast called The Life Changes Show. And I've tuned into that a bit, and I see that you regularly have musical guests in addition to, what would you say, inspirational sorts of guests?
Actually, the good thing about the Life Changes Show is that we can have almost anybody, because everybody experiences life changes.
Yeah.
But not everybody is necessarily conscious of some of the life changes they're experiencing, but some people actually are conscious of the life changes that they either experience and have a positive effect on them, or they take those life changes and use them to help other people have positive life changes going forward. So we have from doctors and even attorneys want to be on our show, but we haven't had one yet. But we're working on the right one for that. But engineers and physicists and authors and all spiritualists, animal communicators, it's fascinating to me.
Yeah, really. You've got a wide open door, wide open mind. Your bio also says that you earned President Barack Obama's, still president,
true, actually,
Barack Obama's President's Call to Service Award and the Master Award from Save the World Foundation. What can you tell us about those?
I can say that it was a wonderful surprise to receive them. It's wonderful to be recognized and awarded, and it helps other people get to know what we're doing, and it brings more attention our way. I could definitely say that, and it's an honor. And at the same time, I have to balance it out in my mind with the actual work that this is not why I'm doing it, but it's nice to receive that kind of attention.
Really. So maybe it's time for us to get into your book a bit, The Little Dog That Could. And I need to be able to pronounce the little dog's name properly. Chichina. Yeah, Chichina. That makes sense. Okay. And so how did you come to write this book, The Little Dog That Could?
Well, actually, there again, along the lines of what we've been talking about, I did not want to write the book. It was an experience that I had with a dog and over several months, and it was joyful and fun, traumatizing and unbelievable to me, and it caused a lot of emotion inside of me. So when I would share the story, on the rare occasion that I did in full detail, I would break down and it would make me uncomfortable, and I didn't want to relive it. So Dorothy Donahue, who's spiritual advisor and now executive producer of the Life Changes Show, suggested I write the story down. And I thought, what a great idea. And I thought I could just write it down and be done with it. So I wrote it down at this point 10 years ago.
Uh-huh.
And I was done as far as I was concerned. But people kept saying, tell the story. And others say, we heard you wrote it, let us read it. And I thought, well, it's you know, it was for me. I wrote it for me. And it took 9 years, or about 8 years, for me to realize two things, at least, as I'm thinking about it now. One is the story was not for me, or not just for me.
Mm-hmm.
And that part of the reason why I didn't want to share it with the world is because I'm not the person in the book all the time. And I thought I had to be that. And I thought that if I were going to release it, people would expect me to be that, and I wouldn't know what to do. I think you've read the book, so you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
This is, it's so fantastical. It's so magical. And I want to be that guy all the time. I just don't know how. And my friends, when I say that, my friends say, read the book.
Yeah, well, I'm going to walk you through the book so that people will get the story or the bulk of it. And it is so magical that I have to say I struggle with that a bit, you know, and wonder, well, did this story actually happen, or was this constructed by a life coach as a teaching allegory?
You wonder, are you asking?
Well.
You're asking. Okay.
Yeah, I'm kind of asking. I don't know if I'd be able to trust the answer or not. I sort of, you know, I think I've come to believe that it probably did actually happen.
You know, I actually had a similar experience with the Celestine prophecy when I was reading it. I was saying, did this happen? Oh, this would be so great if it did. And I hope it happened. And then it gets to a part of the story where I realized, oh, this did not happen. But I do believe that certain elements in the Celestine prophecy are possible. So now, many years later, I had the experience with the dog. And interestingly enough, before I released the book, I did have a few friends read it. And I had people tell me, you know, if you change this part or put that first, or if you say it happened like this, it's even better. And I said, you know, it might be even better, but if I change one word or one phrase, then I wouldn't be able to say it's 100% true as I recall it.
Okay. So you are saying it's 100% true as you recall it. And one of the things that made it palatable for me was that you were sufficiently like me to be self-questioning as it was going on. It's like you're saying, wait a second, this doesn't fit my model of the world and how it works. And this sounds too woo-woo. So I was glad to see you at least wrestling with that.
And I still do. I can't say that it was one thing that I was doing. If you're talking about towards the end of the where the miracles are happening, which technically the miracles happen from the very beginning, but I can't say whether it was the crystals or the this or the that, and I don't know if really. Actually, I will tell you this, that a couple months ago, I interviewed on our show an animal communicator. And it wasn't until she was sitting directly across from me in the studio that I said, wait a minute, I have to talk to you about a dog. And so we didn't talk until the day after, and I asked her if she could communicate with Chichina. And she didn't know of the book and hadn't read it, obviously, or not so obvious, but she said she didn't know of it. And I said, well, there's this dog. I had an experience with it. Can you communicate with the dog? And she said, give me a list of questions, your picture and her picture, and give me a day with it. So 1 or 2 days later, she sent me back an email saying, I've never had a request like this. Your questions are unusual. And I was asking her, did the dog experience what I experienced, or what did the dog experience?
I can understand you're wanting to know that.
Yeah. I do, exactly. Now, I actually wrote her whole response exactly as she sent it to me on our website at thelifechangesshow.com. And so it's there. But I will say that the thing that surprised me the most is that she says the dog had a mission to meet me.
Yeah.
And the dog's reason was to help me change this, this, and this in my life, which are elements that were mentioned in the book. So did she get it and read it in a day? But then she mentioned a couple things that are not in the book. and that only the dog and I would know.
Oh,
and
my goodness.
Supposedly she was talking to the dog.
Oh, my goodness.
Definitely wasn't talking to me.
Oh, my goodness. Well, I have to tell you, this is venturing out for me because trained as a psychologist, you know, I'm sort of very deeply steeped in scientific method and so on. But I don't think that's the whole story. Mm-hmm. So I'm happy to have this conversation with you, even though it's different territory than I usually venture into on this particular show. So let's start with where the book begins, which is this initial meeting with the dog and how that happened.
Right. By the way, I have to say, I'm happy to be having this conversation with you, too. From an engineering mind background, yes. And the thing is that there is no basis that I know of where this conversation is had. And I'm looking forward to more and more of us having this kind of conversation.
Yeah.
So on the day-to-day plane, I was just my happy self, living my busy life, and couldn't be bothered with anything else around me. But I was very much into my career and my time and my whatever I was my busyness. And I was driving down the road, and I see a dog, and I see lots of dogs. We all see lots of dogs. But for some reason, this little dog looked like it was alone and that she was going to cross a busy street. And my mind said, come to me. Don't cross the street. Come to me. And I thought, what a crazy thing. And then I said, and I argued with myself, what am I going to do with this dog? And the answer came that I was supposed to bring her to a friend of mine. Of all my friends, I said it's supposed to be with this friend of mine.
Yeah.
And so, sure enough, I pull over and get the dog. But on this plane, in this world, the right thing to do was to find the dog's keeper, the dog's owner, right? That was the right thing to do.
Right.
So I did everything I could thinking I would find the right person, the person who owned the dog or wanted her back. She wasn't to be found, or he or she wasn't to be found.
Yeah. And you did the, all the right things to try to locate the owner, and it just wasn't happening.
With true intent, I really thought, you know, on this plane, I really thought this dog needs to go, and she can't stay with me. So it wasn't like, oh, what a great dog, I need to keep her. And when that didn't happen, my mind thought, well, I did, for some reason, think it should go with this friend. And so I took her to this friend, and this friend said, no, I would recognize her if she were my dog, and she's not.
She's your dog. And at the time that the dog came into your life, you describe yourself as someone who liked having things just so. You liked your space organized and
neat.
Yeah,
I hate that part of the story.
Well, I could really relate to it. You know, I could really relate to it. Because I've got enough of that in myself to really recognize it. And early in my marriage, you know, if we get into these things of my wife moving something and setting it here, and I feel like it goes there, and it has to live there, and the toilet paper has to come over the top of the roll, not the underneath. So I really understand that. And so you had a lot of resistance to giving this dog space initially, right? So maybe
and sharing the space.
Yeah, give us some examples of that. I've kind of hinted at it, but
David. well,
this is the old Filippo, not the new one, not the 2017 model.
I cringe. And actually, I did have a publisher say to me, you should remove that whole first chapter. It doesn't make you look good.
you know,
if I'm going to tell it, I'm going to tell it.
Yeah, good for you.
And, And it's the basis for why my life didn't have space, because it was so shut down. Things had to be just so. And I like the examples. I had brocade silk pillows from China that, you know, had to be not just, they weren't just what they were, but they also had to be placed a certain place, and nobody could actually sit on them because it would squish the feathers and that kind of thing. And, yeah. And it made my world uncomfortable for others to come in, and I wondered why people weren't coming in wholehearted, you know, with like open arms.
Yeah. Because,
you know, they'd have open arms. I'm like, oh, those are too open.
Well, you know, you described how friends would want to bring their dog over. Before you had a dog.
Yes.
And it was hard for you to be comfortable with that, which I can totally relate to.
David, I have a feeling we're going to need to talk and get to know each other.
I would love that. So,
but it describes not only what was happening in my exterior environment and why it was important to me to share, because it was describing, whether I wanted to or not, what was going on in my internal environment. So my world wasn't open to, or at least my consciousness wasn't open to, it could be this way or it could happen that way. And things like the subtitle of the book, When the Student is Ready, the Teacher Appears. You know, I wasn't ready for the teacher. Well, not if it looked like that.
Yeah. What? My teacher is a dog?
Yeah, exactly. That's crazy.
What is that saying about me? So after a while, you stopped searching for the owner because you began to be open to the idea that this dog was maybe with you for a purpose, and some of your more spiritually oriented friends were kind of giving you that feedback as well.
Right. That was mainly Dorothy, who from the very beginning, I said to her that that I had found this dog, and I was, I don't know, I felt the need to tell her, even though I didn't know her that well at the time. But there, for some reason, I felt there she would know something. And unfortunately, I didn't like what she knew, even though she ended up being right. She said to me, she says, she's your dog. And I said, no, you don't understand. I can't keep a dog. I travel too much and I perform and I can't have the dog. And she said, she's your dog until you learn the lesson. And the conversation ended uncomfortably because I completely didn't understand that. But I thought, if there's a little bit of truth in that, then I'm going to learn as many lessons as I can. I don't remember how conscious that thought was, but as the first part of the story describes, I try and take in as many lessons as I can. I watch the dog smell and listen and how the dog is taking in the world and using the five senses.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, well, you were a very diligent student, I must say, of the dog. And more and more, you found yourself putting your own busyness and business on the back burner. And looking at the world from the dog's point of view. And so you actually, you began to tune into the dog's sensory awareness of the world and to kind of study the dog's five senses and how she used them. So what did you learn about the five senses from this dog that you didn't already know?
Well, it's interesting. I learned a lot with the dog. And then after writing the book, when I was asked to give presentations on the book, I thought, you know, it'd be interesting to learn more about how dogs hear and smell. And so I keep learning. This is a lesson that keeps growing. And I accept it very willingly because I enjoy learning and there's so much to learn. So that the thing about the senses is I've since learned that obviously I knew this, but the degree to which dogs can hear and dogs can smell is so much more significant than our human ability.
Right.
However, while I was tuning into the dog, it seemed to me like I was able to increase or become more aware of what was available to me to take in from my senses, or at least use them more. So while I'm walking down the street, though I'm always tactile, I haven't taken in the information enough to walk by a rosemary bush and touch it and have the sense of touch it in that moment, where I would have just walked by. Now I have a sense of touch that adds to this moment, and I could smell, and that would add to this moment, and I'm just the world expands.
Yeah, and you know, that's a teaching actually that in psychology, the human potential movement, there were people who specialized in leading workshops to get people to tune to develop sensory awareness.
Wow.
So the dog was giving you a sensory awareness workshop.
That's interesting. Yeah. I'd be interested in that.
Oh yeah. There are
people. Is it something you teach?
Pardon?
Is it something you share? Teach?
No, it's not particularly, but also a big part of Zen, you know, and Zen meditation is to be totally, is to open up your senses as much as possible and being mindful. I just hit my microphone and my gesticulation. I apologize to all.
Well, we're both being Italian.
Yeah, right. Right. It's so easy to be Italian. And so then you began to go beyond, and you began to have a sense that your dog had not only five senses, but perhaps what has been called a sixth sense, that maybe there was some sort of a psychic dimension there. So maybe you can share your – and then in the book you develop some interesting ideas about the sixth sense and how to define it and understand it for yourself. So I invite you to go there.
Well, it's interesting that since writing the book and releasing it, I have done more research because I care to share, and I like knowing myself, that when it seems like the dog is perceiving our emotions, like the dogs know that for some reason the dog knew that I was sad, or potentially cats as well, but we see more of this with dogs, is my understanding. So though it seems like the dog is tuning into us or is psychically aware or something, science will just say that the dog can smell the hormones that are being released. Mm-hmm. When we're sad, we release a certain hormone which has a scent, and the dogs can pick that up, which we can't. Mm-hmm. So that's how a dog knows it, that somebody's sad, somebody's happy. And that's why we could look at a dog and be happy and the dog's tail would wag, kind of thing.
Yeah.
You know, while they're sitting there, and they know that you're happy because they can smell it. Now, beyond that, stories of dogs being left, in one part of the country by mistake as the family traveled to the other part of the country, and the dog finding the family, you know, months later or something, right?
Yeah.
Stories of a dog that would continue have a certain dog walk that her and their owner would do, and then one day, after doing that many days in a row or years, the dog stops in front of a manhole that was always there, but for some reason the dog stops. And when the owner tries to get the dog to move and looks at the manhole and thinks, what's going on here, and touches the manhole collapses. How would the dog know that had they stepped on it, they would collapse that particular day when they had stepped on it every day? Or people being buried and the dog from their home going to where the person was buried and never knowing where the person was buried. So is that sent, you know? And so there is this, there is what I understand that science says there's something that we don't know yet or something that we haven't discovered, et cetera, et cetera. So to me, it went beyond the five senses. It went beyond possibly even beyond animal communicating. It felt like we were both not communicating necessarily with each other. I don't have the words to describe this yet, if ever. It felt like we were together someplace else and having a normal conversation.
You described talking to her in your mind.
Right.
And then in your mind, getting an answer, feeling like she was communicating back to you.
Right. And animal communicators and animal trainers tell us that animals communicate with pictures or best communicate with pictures, and that we can actually hold a picture in our mind and the animal can receive that, and vice versa. The animal communicators say they see pictures. Mm-hmm. I didn't have that particular experience. To me, it was actually like talking, but since it's not in a place that I'm used to talking, I say that it was in my mind, and yet it felt like it was someplace. It felt otherworldly.
Okay. And you know, in fact, you may have a particular sensitivity to that dimension, which I think some people do. And you shared a very powerful personal story about the sixth sense in relation to your grandmother and her dying when you were a little boy. Mm. Maybe you can share that snippet with us.
Sure. I don't want to give too much away. It seems to be something that touches everybody. And of course, as I think about it, we all experience death in some way. With our loved ones, because obviously we're still here. So I felt that I could communicate with my grandmother, especially when she was in transition from the living experience to the death experience. And so I thought that I could talk to her spirit. And for some reason, I thought that it was hovering somewhere just above her head. So instead of having eye contact with her, I focused my eyes and my intention above her head. And though there were people in the room that she had lived with all her life, her son and her son-in-law that she had known most of her life, they were not able to connect with her in any way, and she babbled and she looked everywhere but at them. And when I'm getting emotional thinking about this, because these are powerful moments. They're what I call life-changing moments. And what I would like to have happen and is happening from more and more of us that have this conversation, and I thank you for having me on to talk about this on your show, David, because if I had known about this when I was a child, then it wouldn't be so woo-woo or so scary or what have you now. But maybe then wasn't the time, but I trust that now is. So if we could really do this, then wow, we could do all kinds of other things. So I connected with what I felt was my grandmother's soul, and I shared with her my feelings of love towards her and gratitude for her in my life. And when I was done, I looked down at her, and she was staring directly at me and had stopped. First of all, everything in the room had stopped. I didn't know there was anything else, but my grandmother looking at me, and then she broke a smile. And I don't know how else that would be possible unless we really connected and communicated. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Thanks for sharing that with us. In the middle of the story, something happens that is truly miraculous, and I'm reluctant to ask you to take us through it for fear that it might be a spoiler and that you'd rather have people get it from the book, is my guess. Do you want to discuss that here, or would you rather leave it as a surprise for listeners?
I'd rather leave it. You know, it's interesting that it's something very traumatic, and I haven't shared it on any of the shows or any of the presentations I've done and all of that, because it's something that people experience individually. I know people that have stopped at that point. And interestingly enough, it's in the middle of the book. So there's obviously another that much to go.
Yeah.
And some people have stopped. And then I know of people that have stopped for a while until they've been able to take that moment in and then restarted the book. So everybody experiences it very differently. And in the book, I share how I experienced it and what came of that.
Yeah, yeah. So I don't know if you want to talk about what you learned from that experience, or we can just go to what you learned from the experience of writing the book.
What I've learned from the experience of writing the book, actually, though it's easier to describe, it's not easier to swallow. And that is, you made mention of it at the beginning. By going through the book several times to make sure the commas were there and the I's were dotted and T's were crossed and all of that, each time I would say, oh, this was the learning I was supposed to, even though there were so many learnings, I'd go back and say, I hadn't learned this, or I hadn't seen this in the story, where of course I saw it because I experienced it and I wrote it down and I'd read it before, but the connections that were made as the dendrites are starting to get used to firing in this way kind of thing, right, in the brain, and I'm making a groove of, okay, yes, this happened, Filippo accepted, yes, this is, and by the last reading, and I haven't read it since now, by the last reading, I was so annoyed with myself. Well, because every time I would experience something amazing or something that Dorothy said came true, or I made the connection, it's like, wow, this is. And that almost immediately after would say, this can't be.
So you got annoyed with the fact that you had not fully accepted and become a true believer? Is that it?
Right. And had I accepted it at the beginning, this whole process might not have taken so long. But more importantly, I'm thinking, where am I still doing that in my life?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
That is keeping me from everything else I want to do.
Uh-huh. Interesting. Yeah. Well, that's a major lesson right there. And it occurred to me that with the rereading of the book, it reminded me of, it would be like looking at a dream. And as we, if we look at a dream over time and keep coming back to it, we find that, there's more and more there that we hadn't first realized. And in many ways, our lives perhaps are more metaphorical than we realize.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. As a matter of fact, thanks to the process of the book, the reading of it, the understanding of exactly what you just said, I created from that experience and many others what I call the recalibration, which takes us back to something we were talking about at the beginning of the show, David, and that is to say, to look at our lives, to look at what we've done or what we wanted to do and are glad we didn't, or wanted to do and are sorry we didn't, and all of that stuff, what happened and shouldn't have happened, and quotes in the air for all of that, and to say, well, wait a minute, that has made us this. Now, looking back, do we still want that? Do I still believe that? And is that still important in my life? And what have I not integrated of all these things? Mm-hmm. So some people, I had a yellow experience and I had a red experience. And if we leave those together, we just have a yellow experience and a red experience. But if we recalibrate and look at it, we might be able to bring those experiences together. And all of a sudden we have a new color. We have orange. And now our palette expands and our world expands. And so now we say, oh, wow, now we have this. And do we like it? Do we not like it? What do we do with it? How do we move forward? And we call that the recalibration.
Okay. By the way, sometimes things are slow to come to mind, but you might want to write down the name Charlotte Selver. Charlotte Selver.
Selver, okay.
S-E-L-V-E-R. I think she was originally from Germany, and she's somebody who built a career around sensory awareness.
Okay.
So...
S-E-L-V-E-R. I've got it.
Yeah. And so what are you hoping that people will get out of reading the book?
Well, like I got out of the experience, I'm hoping that they will get what it is that they need. So when the student is ready, the teacher appears, that if they read the book because we're friends or because they know me or because they heard me on your show, then the book and the experience, they're called to it. So the people that got that read halfway through got what they needed to get or got something mm-hmm. that would help them, the five senses. Or I've had people share with me that they never thought of their dog as actually a being they could communicate with, or it has allowed them to communicate with their dog better, or their cats, or their birds, or their horses. And I've had actually people ask me, can this work with humans?
That's good.
Only hope. Yeah. We could all communicate better.
Yeah. Well, I love that. Yeah, part of the reason why I went ahead with this was I was hooked by the dog. I like dog stories. I like dogs. And I'm always amazed by the relationship that we have with dogs and that they have with us. And your whole experience deepens all of that. That's certainly something that somebody can get out of reading your book. And I've often, too, marveled at the fact that we have this longing to meet creatures from outer space, you know, other beings. And we have beings right here.
Nice.
Who are other, you know, and who are still learning to communicate with.
That's perfect, David. That is perfect. And you know, one thing that I thought of that relates to your question about could this be a life coach wanting to advertise kind of thing. It's interesting. Also, what I want people to get out of the book is that we, there potentially is more than the way we look at life and the experience we're having and how we're having it. And that we can potentially be more individually and collectively. And that if I... back to the, is this true? If I wanted to say, hey, look what I can do, right? Mm-hmm. Or look how great I am. Because I was a life coach all those years ago, but I didn't want to release the book because I didn't want people to know that this happened. Mm-hmm. Because I didn't want to be looked at differently. I was afraid that of all of this. I didn't know how I would answer to all of this. Yeah. And it wasn't a, hey, look at me. And so this goes back to what I wish for people after reading the book is like, hey, look at you. I'm not the only one. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And now it doesn't, more and more for me, it doesn't feel so weird or so woo-woo.
Yeah.
And it doesn't have to happen like this for everybody. It could happen how it could happen to them. And they might have already had these kinds of experiences. And the more we come out, so to speak, mm-hmm. the more other people will say, well, that's interesting. The other day, I had an experience that I actually thought I was talking to the dog. And maybe I was.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, that's true. If you, you know, in my teaching career, I would sometimes ask students about psychic experiences that maybe they had or other, yeah, that other people had in their families and so on. And people always have stories. I think just about everybody has been touched by, in some way, about that they can't totally rationalize or understand unless they subscribe to a particular metaphysical view, you know, that's got that all laid out. But I'm always a little bit distrustful of the theoretical explanations of all of those things. Maybe more than I am of the fact that they happen.
Yes. Well, you know, up until now, a lot of it has been present for my view is that a lot of it has been presented in a way that hasn't appealed to me. And maybe there was a time where, as some people would describe it, that the energies on the planet or this or that, maybe you had to wear only white and maybe you had to sequester yourself and maybe you had to wear all kinds of trinkets and beads and whatever in order to be able to connect because the energies weren't there or what have you. Nowadays, maybe that isn't as necessary. Maybe people that can connect in that way can look like you and I. And we're the same colors, as a matter of fact.
Yeah.
Right. Maybe this is the color.
Yeah. Yeah. So what does this color, this sort of maroon color, mean to you?
You know, I don't know if I... That, you know, the chakras, this is very grounding. It's a root color. Mm-hmm. It's very strong, very grounding. So it maybe I was thinking that we would be talking on such a high level that I needed grounding for this conversation.
But I've never asked myself that question about this color. It's one that I gravitate toward and I gravitate towards red, and the reason for that, I can think of a couple reasons for that, but hey, this is supposed to be a show about you rather than about me. Whenever I wear red, even at this advanced age, people comment and say, oh, you look good. You know, somehow it compliments my skin.
It does.
Red.
Your face, absolutely.
And this is some kind of a shade of red in a way. A muted shade of red. Well, this might be a place for us to wind down, and I wonder if there are any additional thoughts.
Well, this particular interview is happening, though it's evergreen, it's happening at the very beginning of 2017, which you were asking about the color red. That's a energy vibration thing. Well, numbers are thought to have vibration as well. And the number of 2017 is a one, which is new beginning. It's a very strong number. It's a very foundational number. And though I'm not an expert in colors or numbers or vibration, I did focus in on the fact that last year, 2016, was about change and compassion. That's what nine is supposed to be. And so there was a lot of change and a lot of need for compassion in 2016, as I saw it and in my life. So I'm excited about 2017 and the kind of change that is foundational building to empower us to move forward. It's a very forward moving energy. And those who are interested can look all this up. They probably learn more than I'm sharing right now. But to me, I'm excited that this is like a can do, make a difference kind of year, at least for me. that's what I'm feeling. And so through shows like this and conversations like this and books like this, there are all kinds of them out there. I hope and trust that people will allow themselves to make these kinds of foundational changes. Now's a good time.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's a great charge for us as we move into 2017. And Filippo Voltaggio, you're very energizing in your presence, and I really appreciate that. It's been fun speaking with you, and I want to thank you for being my guest on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you for having me.
I found Filippo Voltaggio a delightful guest to converse with. I was a little apprehensive beforehand because his book is a bit further out on the miraculous spectrum than I usually cover. However, I love a good dog story, and so I decided to take a chance. And I'm glad I did. The miracles covered in the book did stretch my credulity, but I don't doubt the deeper insights and truths that Filippo shares, having learned from his little doggy teacher. I certainly don't doubt that Filippo's boundaries were greatly expanded by the experiences he recounts in the book. And in our interview, I found myself responding to his openness and a willingness to let my own boundaries be expanded. After the interview, he shared that although he tries to always be positive, he's tended to have a very negative feeling about psychologists and was surprised to discover me as one that breaks the mold he had in his mind. Darn, those good parts always emerge after I've turned the mic off. I enjoyed the sense of fun that opened up between us very early in the dialogue, despite the initial frustration we had getting our technologies connected. I joked with him after the interview, "How many engineers does it take to communicate?" We both had a good laugh with that one. I can well imagine that people find him a good coach. I enjoyed his openness and his willingness to question and to learn. And I'm glad that I expressed a bit of my cautious skepticism openly in the early part of the interview. He was able to hear it non-defensively, and it created the groundwork for our honest interchange. As always, you can order Filippo Voltaggio's book, The Little Dog That Could, A True Story of Life, Love, and Miracles, using the Amazon affiliate widget in our right-hand sidebar.
Hi, Dr. Dave. This is Nikki Amaria Sargent, and I wanted to say thank you. I want to say I was a therapist in a clinical practice in a rural community that for many years, and it didn't have, still doesn't have, much in the way of public mental health resources, let alone training opportunities for its therapists. My personal journey led me into analysis, and then analytic training, and finally to be a certified union analyst. My rural colleagues supported me in all of this, despite questioning the relevance and the value of what I was doing. I still live in that country, or community, though I practice in Palo Alto. Your podcasts have helped me learn of fields of study and persons of amazingly rich research and competence I know I have enjoyed greatly. I've told my rural cohorts about your interviews. This has helped them grow as clinicians, better serve their patients, understand me, and get CEU units without extensive driving and big carbon footprints. I'm so grateful for all your time and efforts to put together quality programming, bringing the treasures of depth psychology into contemporary discussion, and helping weave together communities of kindred spirits. Thank you, Dr. Dave.
Well, thank you, Nikki Sargent, for that message and for helping to get the new year off to a great start here at Shrink Wrap Radio. In addition to our regular donors, we have some new ones to help ring in the new year. I'm happy to announce the following new donors: Bonnie L. Getz, Kelsey LeSueur, Michael Gintner, John Gonsolin, Betty Florence Pinzon, Sylvan Berut, Margareta Scheipner, and Jennifer Green. Thank you all. Now, while adding their names to our honor roll, I have the unfortunate task of deleting people from our donor honor roll who've not made a donation in the past year. If I have taken your name off by mistake, please let me know. Particularly painful is the fact that we've lost 4 out of our 5 top donors at the ultra-colossal level of $35 a month. Now, those 4 were at the top of the list for a number of years, and I can understand that their finances or priorities may have changed. I'm extremely grateful for all their past support. However, this does create an opportunity for you to make a real mark in helping to keep Shrink Wrap Radio going in the coming year. If your finances allow it, won't you please consider becoming a regular ultra-colossal donor? If you scroll through the list on our honor roll page, you'll see that the show is supported by a relatively small number of donors, especially considering that between 7 and 8,000 are listening every week. Well, what about the advertisers, you ask? I'm appreciative of such advertising opportunities as we've had, but those ads don't bring in much income. One of the things that makes Shrink Wrap Radio such a great value is that there are transcripts, thanks to a select few passionate listeners who donate their time and energy in this way. So I'm happy to announce the following new transcripts. Number 489, The Promise of Technology for the Aging Brain with Dr. Adam Ghazali, which was originally transcribed by Barclay Lebrasseur and then reworked by Matthew Dolitz of The Neuropsychotherapist into a much more beautiful format. Number 518, Understanding Addiction as a Developmental Disorder with Maya Solovitz, thanks to Ellie Knobs. And number 475, The Social and Psychological Impact of AI and Robotics with John Markov. And again, that's thanks to Barclay Lebrasseur.
Hi, I'm John Fredrickson, author of the 2013 book, Co-Creating Change, Effective Dynamic Therapy Techniques. And you're on the couch now with Dr. Dave.
Thank you, John Fredrickson, who has a new book out and who will be our next guest. More about that in a bit. Now let's go to some recent emails from our listener community. First, we hear from Sylvan, who writes, Dear Dr. Dave, thank you for your message. I'm a longtime listener and fan of Shrink Wrap Radio, and for me, it seems very natural to give back a little bit of what I receive from the wonderful job you're doing for the community. Your interviews are really great, and I learn a lot by listening to your interesting guests. I would like to thank you particularly for the interview you did with Dara Hoffman-Fox. This interview has been an eye-opener for me. I already had a vague sense of it before, but it made me realize I may also be non-binary rather than a certain gender in my case. I had previously already heard that some people identify as neither male nor female, but it remains quite abstract for me. In this interview, it became much more concrete and resonated a lot with my own feelings. It opened new perspectives for me and a lot of exploration possibilities. Thanks a lot for all your great work. Warmly, Sylvan. Well, Sylvan, thanks for that feedback. I must say you have inspired me to list that interview with Dara Hoffman-Fox on our website in the Best Of area. Thanks for calling my attention to it again. Next, we hear from naturopath Ralph Woody Wilson, who writes, David, best of the new year to you. Your dynamic internet presence has been a major anchor as I rebuild my life after extreme events during the wartime called the Vietnam era. Those of us who were in the midst of that turmoil went through traumas that created what I have termed war-affected brains. A very similar process is now happening to those active and veterans currently since 9/11. Now that we are in the longest wartime stance in our nation's history, when I discovered your superb work over 10 years ago, I began to understand the painful depths of unique conditions such as PTSD. The current transition from the leadership of President Obama to the coming leadership of President Trump is bringing our country to the point of deep self-examination, each of us, as we look at our responsibilities in the world. I look forward to 2017 and the Shrink Wrap Radio podcasts and other ways you will be contributing to our future. I enjoyed the film Sully, about a pilot in an extremely urgent situation. You, Dr. Dave, are, quotes, doing your job, adapting a quote from Sully, as psychology educator and inspiration for all people, regardless of ideology, religion, nationality, etc. Onward into 2017, and it's signed Ralph Wood, Woody Wilson, founder of nonprofit RouteFinders.org. Much love, my friend, and it's signed Woody. Well, Woody, thanks for your long-standing support for me and Shrink Wrap Radio, and a big happy new year to you as you continue to, as Sully said, do your job. Finally, we hear from Kelsey LeSueur, who writes, "Hi, Dr. Dave. I've been listening to your podcast on and off for a while. I'm an artist nearing 30 in New York City, always having had a great interest in scientific concepts, especially psychology, but having some learning difficulties, so never took the academic route. This podcast is a great way for me to still learn about these topics. I just listened to episode number 503, Exploring the Disease Model Debate with Professor Peter Kinderman. This episode in particular made me feel so much better about myself and how to frame things differently. I guess it's a tool that people use, calling things disorders, to take the pressure off and make people feel that it's not their fault. But to me, it makes me feel more inevitable and helpless. I love that he stresses that because people have difficulties, it doesn't make them wrong. It just points to the fact that people's brains are so variable, in the same way that people have different kinds of noses or skin color or different teeth. There are healthy ways to have any kind of brain you have, and different choices you can make to live the best you can with what tools you have, and it's possible to be okay. For some reason, this episode really made me feel that in a big way. I've always struggled with anxiety and depression, like many of us, and hope to someday train myself to live in my mind in better ways. I will be starting therapy for the first time soon. Anyway, thank you very much for your podcast and to all your speakers. I made a small donation today as a contribution. Happy holidays," and that's from Kelsey LeSueur. Well, Happy New Year, Kelsey. I really like the way that you put that people have different brains, just like they have different noses and so on, and that they're okay. So I thank you for your contribution, and I plan to keep bringing you content that has the potential to help ease your way. And with that, I think we better wrap it up for today. You can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. You can also leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site. And you can leave voicemail on our message phone at 415-830-4014. Or you can use our app for that, and you can find full information about the app on our website under the Apps tab. So thanks to Filippo Voltaggio for his delightful reflections on animal communication. My next guest will actually be a return guest, John Fredrickson, speaking about his new 2017 book, The Lies We Tell Ourselves, How to Face the Truth, Accept Yourself, and Create a Better Life. So until then, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind. We'll be right back.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.